Okay. All right. Great. Anyway, this is all I'm going to do is try to start a discussion. And as I already told Dragon this morning, I'm sort of less optimistic than I was once I started looking at the numbers. So and I think there are more discussions next week, right, about dark energy and things like that. So I'm going to try to, in principle, I guess the topic was supposed to be large-scale structure and how we can get primordial physics. And of course, this is great in some regards because we really have, initial conditions. And by initial, just let me mean, post-inflation. So I have to consider the fact that I don't know what reheating did. So there's a lot of unknown thermodynamics, but I have initial conditions. I have gravitational evolution, both, the interesting stuff for the background and how the perturbations grow. And I've got the unknown matter in thermodynamic history, at least in detail. And then I've got all the stuff that makes it hard, which is astrophysics and observing techniques before I get, between the stuff that we're talking about all the way to the stuff that I see. So it's a cool opportunity in some ways because really all unknown physics that we're interested in participates here. And so far we've sort of split all of those things off. If non-Gaussianity is large, we can just look at least qualitatively for signatures for that without worrying about a lot of this stuff. Many modified gravity theories don't necessarily crosstalk with your non-Gaussianity and stuff like that. But since the numbers are small, since we don't see any deviations yet, this all becomes a much harder game. And maybe there are also ways in which, when we are aiming our favorite observations to go after one thing, we can really try to make the most of looking at observations that are interesting in these multiple areas. So my sort of proposal for what it might be good for us to do is, first of all, to decide what are our benchmark observations and lowest limit values that we think are interesting from a theoretical point of view. We're lucky that we have those in some sense, the smallest non-Gaussianity we're interested in. And if we decide on what those things are that we want to go after, so let me say benchmark measurements. And numbers, then we have more concrete questions to ask people that have to do all the hard work here of sorting out whether we can do it or not. I guess the second question would be, in that same spirit, do we have what we need in terms of very near future surveys to achieve those goals? So, and by near future, I just mean basically everything where the planning is finished, so we don't have much influence over how those surveys are done. Do we want to influence farther future surveys, right, which mostly are aimed at dark energy stuff, but maybe we want to try to say we change the observing strategy slightly, that's better for primordial physics. And once we look at these numbers, do we actually think that this is really where we want to be spending our time, or does it only get us sort of qualitatively further from Planck, but not to numbers that are really, really interesting in terms of primordial physics? Do we actually want something else, which would be higher Z or smaller K? Is it worth it, basically, to do all this stuff for large-scale structure? Is it just really hard for the gains that we get? So that's my basic outline.
I have a question about this work. I mean, we have our primordial interest in these things, but in working out what would be needed, would you learn things about real physics that would be interesting anyway? I mean, that seems like an obvious way to lower bound how the answer to 4. Or whatever, how much the work is worth it.
Well, and it's not going to be our personal work, I guess. So it seems like, at least talking with Dragon, the will is there to do this, for somebody to do this. People are interested in carrying out those calculations.
All those things advertised for dark energy, not astrophysics. It's all funding. Every time you go, it's all about dark energy. And the errors drop like a rock with higher K. And higher Z also
gives you a couple of smaller K she's talking about.
I think
more linear.
So then it's a bit more iffy.
Right.
For that, but.
But it goes in both directions, though. When you go to higher Z, the linear, the nonlinear scale becomes smaller, and therefore you have both high K and smaller K.
Yeah. So I guess.
But to answer Eva's question, like one obvious thing is as you push to higher Z, you can see galaxy evolution.
Okay.
For people who are interested in galaxy formation, that's a good thing to see.
Yeah, that sounds interesting.
But says we should go and look at these objects. But should we do the same types of calculations that we want to do? Working on like actually calculating the bispectrum carefully in higher order, perturbation theory to galaxy people want to do that, or they just want to look at properties of the galaxies?
Are galaxy formation people, are they interested in clustering?
Yeah.
At some level, yes. If you build some kind of halo model for the galaxies, clustering is one way to constrain those models.
At the 2-point level, that's probably true, right? But for like something like the bispectrum, sort of imagine learning a lot about galaxy formation from the bispectrum.
Right. So the question is: Are people in gas formation? Are they interested in the third moment of the halo distribution function?
it's hard to imagine.
I haven't heard that discussed yet.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't it help to have more information?
We already have lots of information. We don't know what to do with it. Right.
You mean just from the power spectrum, or
from the power spectrum, things like group statistics of galaxies? Right. Yeah. So we currently have lots and lots of information about galaxies, where they form, which objects they're in. And the problem is that we don't know now how to make reliable predictions to match even the current observations. And so more measurements of things like high order correlations is not clear to me what that will teach us about the micro physics of star formations and galaxies.
Okay. Yeah, if we care about star formation, or those types of details. But, So here's a really dumb example, and you can tell me why astrophysicists don't care about it. But let's say I care about biasing, and I say there's the possibility of quadratic term in biasing, and there's some paper by Baldoff, is that his name, and Nurosh and company, where they say from computing that at the level of the power spectrum there are certain terms that are all degenerate. You can't tell the difference. But when you go to the three-point function, you can tell the difference between like tidal effects versus just density squared effects. That's obviously important if you want to follow this program for non-Gaussianity, but would you say that's just knowing what the form of biasing is just not an interesting astrophysics question, it's just a technical detail, or what's the status of, like, that seems like a concrete situation where measuring by the bispectrum is absolutely what you'd want to do to separate those two effects. So is that just not interesting astrophysics?
I mean, this discussion was, I feel, going in the direction of, the main effort is this halo occupation distribution, how to populate halo occupations.
Okay.
And I think for that, I thought you were saying there's already a lot of data and people are getting help with it, which is like a building block of how to toward, predictions for material galaxies.
But here's maybe.
If you could, for example, measure things like these tidal effects and the HOD, that would be interesting, sure. Compared to just like density effects in the HOD. So our current, sort of schemes, for the current methods that we use for fitting like, galaxy abundances and clustering are based on this halo model HOD. And the simplest ones just assume that the galaxy occupation of halos depends only on masses, whereas physically you might expect it to depend on other things like, for example, formation histories or, for example, tides. And so if we could find sort of clean signatures for things like tidal effects, yeah, I mean, that would be, I guess, kind of interesting.
But like the other
kind of was
how much work is involved in carrying this out? You're debating whether it's good to do, but
yeah, well, that's
going to be doable in the first place.
So that's the other thing that's come up recently, especially as our bounds on FNL get tighter, is that if you try to find forecasts of how well we can do, especially for bispectrum, you know, there's stuff that's extremely hand-wavy, but mostly people have gone back to, can I even match the simulation with the theory? Can I get it right? Can I calculate all this stuff first? And even if you do that in the most optimistic way possible, it looks like the predicted errors on FNL are maybe one. And
FNL, which one?
Local? Delta FNL. So most of it's done for local. For others, it's probably bigger because the nonlinear terms are bigger.
Yeah, so the improvement from point on the other one was much worse.
Yeah, so that's right. So I guess that's what we should decide if the numbers that we can get from large scale structure after doing all this work and assuming that people want to carry out all these calculations for this other stuff anyway, which they probably will, but it's a lot of work. Are those improvements that are really interesting theoretically, or are they just sort of small improvements? And do we want to focus efforts on coming up with new stuff somewhere else?
Well, so should we talk about different shapes and how much sensitivity you have to them? I mean, because the answers are probably different.
That's right, but I guess part of what I'm saying is in trying to compile those numbers, I can't even find good predictions for stuff that's not local because most of these simulations are local and because the gravitational stuff is bigger in those other shapes. I can give you the numbers for local. I couldn't find good predictions that aren't just really old for other shapes.
I mean, equilateral mode counting should work, roughly.
Mode counting, no question, but then it's all the other stuff.
It's all the other stuff,
that's right.
But that's where all the uncertainty is. But, I mean, you can find predictions for equilateral that are arbitrarily optimistic at some level, and it's a question.
But if I look at people that I trust in what they're doing now,
The reason equilateral is not... So you'd say you wouldn't trust any forecast that doesn't include a simulation. You would say we have to simulate with equilateral before. I mean, even if it's in the linear regime, you'd say I wouldn't trust a forecast. Even for, if I only count linear modes, you wouldn't trust a forecast that doesn't include a simulation.
I would say, and again, I'm not an expert, but the iteration of people writing papers about refining the theory even for local, even in the quasi-linear regime, based on simulations, would say that yes, we need to go back and do those steps before we trust what we're doing. Because people that know and that are doing this are going back and rechecking things for local. So, you know, but again, you know, I'm not the most expert person. This is just listening to.
Yeah. It's perturbative and it's by definition doable. And
so I guess
there are a lot of errors and calculations.
That's right. So I guess the thing was
is it that you don't know when it breaks down? I mean.
So I guess the issue is, at least this is how what Emiliano and those guys would write it, is that if you ask about the bispectrum, you've got the primordial term, you've got the Gaussian gravitational stuff, nonlinear, and then you've got the non-Gaussian nonlinear stuff. And there still seems to be some disagreement about how, you know, exactly how to compute these terms and how big they are. And So I've got the primordial stuff, and I've got the gravitational evolution, which is even. So just go to second order for the second, you know, B2, the second term of the bias, maybe. And then I've got these nonlinear terms from the non-Gaussianity. And the non-Gaussianity is as small as it apparently is. I have to really make sure that I can do all those steps correctly.
But is perturbative? It's supposed to be within the realm. I mean, the correction is supposed to be small.
So if I limit to a certain range of k's where I think I can do this calculation, yes. But then I also have the simulation, so I try to match the linear regime to the simulation, and the simulation can do the nonlinear part. But, you know, so that's people are going back and trying to match the simulations with these other terms.
So here, are you talking about the matter bispectrum or the galaxy bispectrum?
Well, I guess people are still doing dark matter bispectrum, right? So.
Yeah, that's right. There's your little
exactly. So then there's even that on top of that. That's right. That's right. Okay. So. Right. Right. Even harder. So.
The issue is to get this the best constraints you want. You can. You want to go to as high k as possible. On the other hand, that's at some point that is non-productive and it's hard to make reliable predictions. So you somehow have to decide how far you can push, and you need somehow some guidance from simulations.
Can I just ask a question, back up a second? So to get primordial physics from large-scale structure is the only avenue probing non-gas gravity? Because you seem to go into that very quickly, and so is that where I'm really sure?
So you said to get information about?
About the primordial physics, so you've heard plus primordial physics.
Yeah.
If you want to get primordial physics from large-scale structure, is there another goal other than probing non-gas gravity in some way?
So I guess by non-Gaussianity, we just mean all of the correlation functions of the initial conditions. And so if you define primordial by initial conditions, then any statistics of the initial conditions.
But the shape of the power spectrum, I mean, also.
Right, sure. So in fact, I don't just mean, in fact, I mean everything from counting stuff to shape of power spectrum and all the other correlations.
Could it do better on the NS, for example? Could it find oscillations? Could it work features? Could it, all these things be used for that? Or is it too rough?
Probably not very much, because the range of scales, well, I guess you can go to smaller, can you go to smaller scales in large scale structure to get the lever arm?
Yeah, that's a
not
that's
sure. Well, right, yeah, in a certain setting, things like substructure, we can get down to like sort of a K of 100 or so, it looks like. That's interesting, I guess.
Do you have any reliable way of guessing how? So the reason I think it's could be interesting is just because the tilt is getting to where it's starting to make distinctions that are really interesting, but it hasn't really yet done that. And so I guess the CMB people were telling us at the conference that it was going to improve, but maybe by a factor of order one. And then I forget exactly what the projections were, but it maybe the error bars wanted to shrink by a factor of two, but a little less than that from CMB. And that's good, but. But yeah, my naive question was what you said is, do we have a lever from the short scales? So sorry, you probably just entered it and I didn't quite catch. Do you anticipate?
I do anticipate pushing to smaller scales than we currently have.
And do you have an idea for a shape error bar on NS?
On NS, no, I don't know.
What would go into trying to estimate that?
Mm-hmm. No, it would be easy, yeah,
But it's trusting the small scales, that's a huge thing, right?
Well, trust means, what does that mean? Sorry,
that it's the same primordial P of K that's taking you all the way to small scales with secondary effects that you can model, like baryonic physics.
Oh, well, right, yeah, so we're trying to, probe the, as we're trying to probe the nonlinear structure and the dark matter. So hopefully those objects will not be so affected by gravity.
I see, you're talking about dark matter.
Yeah, dark matter substructure.
Right? Dark matter substructure, oh, right, I see. Right.
Yeah.
Through like lensing?
Yeah, through lensing, exactly,
oh, okay.
Right. Yeah, and so since these objects presumably have not been significantly affected by baryons, that should be, then N-body simulations should be reasonably reliable to go from the linear power spectrum to like full non-linear structure.
Right.
Yes, we will have improved bounds on the power spectrum. That's in terms of K, right? So the force, so currently the envelope force, sort of gets down to like K by one or so, right? Or a few maybe. And so with lensing, it looks like we can get down to sort of like K of 100. And so I'm not sure what that extra lever arm in K translates in terms of NS, but there will be some improvement. Perhaps pushing the higher redshift, in the far future, if we can do 21 centimeter from the moon or something, we could then probe many, many linear modes, beyond what we have currently. What that time trend is. The retirement party of my students or something,
But you're saying you can get to K of 100, whereas one example is K of 1?
Like order like one or a few or something. Is that all right for the forest?
Forest is about one, yeah. K of 1.
Do you have to do it from the moon? I mean, low far or something like that won't be helpful.
Oh, right, yeah, so the issue with doing 21 centimeter at such high redshift is that the frequencies become very low.
Right, I know that.
In the Earth's ionosphere, apparently makes it impossible.
So how low can low far go in terms of?
In terms of redshift. Yeah. So I thought that low far was mainly going after reionization as opposed to.
So 10-ish.
10-ish as opposed to like 50.
Okay, and so the moon is needed otherwise.
Just beyond the ionosphere, I think
right,
is needed.
Got it.
Right. So and the moon has a surface. I don't know.
It's tough to do astronomy on the moon. A lot of crap.
I haven't tried it yet.
Well, so what do you gain by measuring this matter power spectrum to such small scales?
So longer lever arm, you know, in terms of. Of the K gives you a better handle on the results.
Does it give you much of a better handle? Will it be a big improvement for that amount of work?
Well, so currently I guess we have sort of down to K at 1 and the lowest K we can reliably believe on is like 0.01 or something. Maybe yeah, so I'm sort of doubling the lever arms.
But that's also where it's useful to talk about. Let's talk about higher correlation, because you want to compare what you get for that amount of work. Mm-hmm. If you said, okay, let's go with the crazy optimistic scenario where I'm just going to say, I trust my simulation so much that I will, like, I can go to whatever K I can measure and I'll plug it in a simulation. So you say you could go to K of 100. Mm-hmm. You gain in terms of number of modes measured by whatever K you can go to cubed. So if you went from 1 to 100, cube that, you gained a factor of a million in modes, so you're, you know, all your error bars go down by a factor of 1,000. So if you could do that, that's a huge, I mean, that kind of improvement is greatly worth whatever effort it would take you if you believe that this would end up in you trusting mm-hmm. your results. So in terms of what's the power is absolute, like, for every tiny improvement, you gain in the cube of that. So it's,
right, but it won't be as rosy as that because that would be like amazing to use those models. But I think he's probably referring to a more limited application, which is just maybe some range of K at high K, and maybe blow up the error bars because you're not exactly sure about everything. But even without the K cubed effect, just doubling the lever arm would help. On the
you're
right.
Saying there's some specific Ks that you aim for that have structure.
I think like if you have a bunch of Ks from 10 to the minus 2 to 1, and then if you just have one more K at high K.
But that K that you're referring to at high K is some particular scale of structure.
100.
That
K of 100. Even that
well,
will just.
Well, this will have constraints on substructure. Or, you know, over some range of masses, which therefore translates into a range of K. It isn't just like a single.
Right,
you know,
right.
Window, but yeah. But you're right, though. You're right that the error per K mode will not be as good as it was. So this 1,000, I think, might be
1,000 was fairly optimistic.
Yeah.
But we're also talking about different numbers because I was comparing to 1, where we won't measure a bispectrum with Lyman alpha because also the error bars are big. So. For what we were current, like, so we haven't got to projections, but projections won't even go that far. So you'll say projections for the phi spectrum, you wouldn't trust above, let's say, is 0.1 fair? That's what most people say, where you wouldn't even give me 0.1 inside your, what that basis is. You don't trust 0.1.
I still know.
No, but I mean, that's it's the same thing. If you said, it's the same, replace 0.1 and even just go a factor of 10, a factor of 10 is square root of 1,000 improvement, which, so if we're, these are huge, huge gains. So it's, at that level, it's totally worth the effort. It's definitely worth trying to push that theoretically than building the survey, the survey on the moon, and then, to get, and then only stopping at the equivalent of 0.1. I mean, mm-hmm. it's definitely cheaper to do the theory work to try and push that scale than to ask for 21 centimeter out to redshift to 50, I think. It'd be great to have both, but in terms of cost, the cost benefit for theory is definitely a lot lower, or you got a lot more bang for your buck.
We're cheap, yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
So the work you do again is just continue with the perturbation theory, also do simulations, and thereby check whether the coefficients in your perturbation theory are large or not. The next coefficient.
Yeah, basically, so, just how far do you trust? I mean, there's also, so that's at the level of dark matter, and then there's also this question of how far do you trust your modeling of where the galaxies are? Like if you're using a galaxy-like survey, you know, there's this other uncertainty, which is we observe galaxies, we don't observe dark matter. Perturbation theory, to some degree, and definitely simulations are entirely about pure dark matter, no.
Are you talking about the bias?
Yeah, so there's the biasing of the fact that dark matter is clumped, and then there's the additional biasing of the fact that galaxies are not the same as the clumps of dark matter.
Yeah, that's
so
one.
There's sort of orders and orders of this procedure, but in principle,
that latter one is not analytically calculable in perturbation theory because it includes baryons, or is this a...
Well, so this is, again, a question. The way that people do it, as far as I can tell, is you parameterize the effect with some coefficients that are unknown, but then you could, in principle, measure those coefficients. And if you believed all that you had to do to predict reliably was know a few coefficients that you can't predict from theory, then this is not, I don't see why that's a fundamental obstacle to going forward.
If you're confident that your choice of parameterization is actually capturing the physics.
Okay, but this is a theory question, right? Yeah. This is not
the effective theory of large scale structure kind of question.
So this is one step beyond. So effective theory of large scale structure is the perturbation theory for just the dark matter.
But it also has some parameters that you're
fixing. So here you'd add more parameters on top of that to capture these clustering effects, as in where galaxies live. And then your question would be, is the process of going from perturbation theory, which goes up to some scale, to what we observe being galaxies, if all that you need to know to make the map between those two is some number of coefficients that you can measure from either simulations or from data directly, then there's no problem. But to the extent that you can't, so the question is partly, can you do that? If you can do that.
I'm going to show some plots next week. I don't know if you're sticking around that long, that will show examples of this numerically. So there's going to be example, as you go to higher k, five coefficients for, I forget, five values of k, and then there's also redshift range, so 25 coefficients for five values of k and five values of z. And so there's so much information in high k that you survive even after 25 extra coefficients, you still have a lot. But maybe you need 125, you know, and
they're
kind of hard to measure also. So
that's a question. You want to know at what point is your gain in a number of modes being over swamped by the number of new coefficients you have you need to add to model the clustering. But
again, this model is phenomenological the way you're describing it. I mean,
no. You don't know what this model of galaxy.
It's not unreasonable. The assumption that goes in, people put in different assumptions, but I think at some very basic level, the assumption is the formation of galaxies is a local process. That I think if it's not a local process, that's an extremely interesting fact in and of itself.
Yeah, but local on some scale, right?
I can tailor expand. I mean, local just means finite size box. Like if there's effects outside the box, I can ignore. So that box may be big, but I can, as long as it's confined to a box, I can always move stuff to the center of the box and add derivatives. I mean that's what I mean by local. I think that's not an unreasonable assumption. Now with derivatives adds the number of parameters, but it's still, I mean, it's only if it's really, there's no parametric separation. There's not, I can think of a box this size in the universe, I have to think of the whole universe at once. If that matters, then I'm totally screwed. So I think the locality assumption doesn't seem unreasonable.
You're saying there's no uncertainty, again, I'm just asking totally basic questions, but you're saying there's no issue with baryon effects, et cetera, or where does that come into?
I mean, there could be, right. You could imagine that, for example, forming quasars over here, 20 megaparsecs away, might affect the formation of my galaxy over here. Right. Help them break this locality assumption. As far as we can tell, though, those effects are fairly small. But at this level of precision, is it small?
For example, like your AGN could shine only part of its lifetime and turn off and shine again, you know, that totally will affect your modeling, right? Maybe you have to put it
off. So the time at which some local region of the universe reionizes, that time could depend upon what's happening on some very large scale.
And that time will then affect the future galaxy formation and subsequent history of that region. So physically, it's not implausible to think of ways to break this sort of locality assumption that's intrinsic to all of this galaxy bias.
So when we talk about locality, nobody's doing something crazy and, you know, non-causal, but you're asking how much of a memory you have of the
memory effect is probably you would probably say is the biggest worry. That's these like, what happened because of some random thing here involving a quasar dramatically affects the number of galaxies we observe in that region.
So the colors of those galaxies, these sort of things, right?
So you don't have to deal with, you know, cooling effects that involve more than just the gravitational interactions and the dark matter. I mean, is that kind of thing too small scale?
To the extent that that's small scale and you assume that's just parameterized in these coefficients, then...
So the problem is we've got to talk about the baryons. What are they? What is the leaking effect? Is it what you were talking about?
Oh, sorry? No.
With the baryons not being included in the calculations, what is the...
Oh, so why is it hard, you're asking?
What is the leading thing you're missing when you're doing this?
So you're not including the physics of the star formation. The stars determine what you actually see in the galaxy, the physics is occurring on tiny, tiny scales, which we cannot reliably calculate along with the galaxy scale and also large scale structure.
So it goes back to the star formation. So you put that in as a phenomenological thing so far.
Yes, all this is done as sub-weird physics, we call it. And sub-weird models are just phenomenological models, I would say.
That's why you talk about the memory thing.
Well, so that's just one possible,
But you seem to be saying, so when stars form, it's not before they're forming, the fact that baryons could interact differently, and so it pushes out regions. And just the composition of the fluid you're looking at, the galaxy, isn't it important that baryons are not dark matter and interacting differently? It's not. I thought you were saying that these things form AGNs or something and blow out regions, but isn't it the very formation process itself that you're trying to model?
By the formation process of the galaxy. Sure. Right.
So, I mean, can't that steepen the profile or blow up the
thing? It can do either.
There's both formation and blowing up, both. But I guess formation might be more important.
I see.
I know you're talking about more than just the star formation level. You're talking about something.
Well, so the stars form from the stars form from the gas, right? Yeah. So if you change what the gas is doing, it will then later on change what the stars are doing, which changes with the galaxy appearance.
Okay, but you said all the star formation.
Well, so fundamentally, for galaxies, what we observe is just the light and the color and things like that. That's determined from the stars today, which is determined from the whole history of star formation throughout the past.
And their explosions, does that not matter?
Sure, their explosions are supernovae and there's black holes and invincible. So in principle, all that messy physics and in fact the subsequent appearance of the galaxy.
Okay, so, sorry for all the dumb questions, but this is helping a lot. So. Those kinds of things are clearly very hard.
Yes.
They're not some perturbative calculation you're trying to carry out to the next order.
But then
the question is, can you...
But a lot of people who are trying to get ahead, they're not starting ground up. So Elisa Wexler, who's not here in the room, but she's at the workshop, she has one of the leading, most popular prescriptions for assigning galaxies to halos, and it's not this star formation winds. It's more very, very phenomenological. I don't know exactly what it entails, we probably know more. It's assigning galaxies to halos and just matching a bunch of observations and just kind of doing some kind of minimization.
And this is the thing where you introduce parameters and you hope you have
the right. And you hope that you have a good enough parameter.
So it's not starting from star formation.
And I mean, in other areas, there are famous examples of this, as I understand, like supernova light curves.
Right. It's very much like that. Okay. Very much like that.
But it's also in this context. I mean, no one's asking, like, if you look in this spot with this amount of dark matter, can you predict the color and size of the galaxy. We're talking about averaging over large numbers and talking about, are there more galaxies here on average compared to over there on average, which are separated by, you know, cosmological scales. So that you're not asking for super sharp detailed questions on small scales. And that's, I mean, for the purpose of, say, primordial physics, you're asking about correlation functions on very large scales.
So now we were just talking about k to 100, right? Or
But even if we got k to 1, that would be, I mean, k of 1 would be such a huge improvement over k of 0.1. And we're talking more, like slightly different, you know, small improvements. And so yeah, k of 100 is probably not reasonable, but, right. But at some point this should be manageable, and it's a question of over, because again, you just need this to work well enough, right? You don't need this to predict precisely the shape and form and every detail you want to know about the galaxy. You just want to know, are there more on average here or less in a way that maps back to the initial statistics reasonably reliably? And that's what you need to do. So a parameterization of that doesn't seem like a completely unreasonable thing, and you'll add some shot noise in to account for the fact that you don't, this doesn't work perfectly. And you hope that's good enough. But.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yes, this was an strong lens in individual objects. Right. Yeah.
Okay, so you're measuring the
condo. That's
right. Right. So that's the context of the K1. Yeah. So we're not talking about. So then, is there a use of large surveys, or should all the surveys be?
Right. So science is pushing to high K. There's also other problems of primordial physics, like for example, light spectrum and things like that. So there's many different areas that we're pushing in, besides just pushing up to high K.
If you're pulling strong ones in, then do you need to understand these kind of bias questions?
So probably not, since we're just counting the abundance of objects as opposed to, for things like measuring the galaxy bias spectrum, that this is crucial.
But should we all just be, looking at dusty galaxies with ALMA and just measuring K at 100 really well?
No, I mean, you have lots of folks.
No, I mean, would that give like a lot of gain for the bias, for example, to just have one K measurement way out, so you don't need to worry about all this bias?
That's sensitive to different types of physics than the bias spectrum is, right?
No, I'm just saying, what is that gain mean? Since you don't need to know this topic, does that gain you a lot, and should you be focusing on that?
You should fund me, I agree, but... you should also be able to fund other things as well. That's all.
Speaking of which, Neil, can you give us an update on these flux anomalies? Have the constraint improved since your work?
No, not at all. Assuming it will improve as long as all the attacks are generous to us in this time.
Improved by how much?
By orders of magnitude.
Can you explain what you're talking about?
Okay, yeah. It was about 10 years ago, we had published constraints on an undark matter substructure that exists inside of ordinary galaxy halos. But that bound was, the constraint was, well, the error bar was large, because the sample size we had 10 years ago was small. And so now we have larger samples of objects next to various CMB surveys. And so we probe those objects using ALMA, which is this recently built millimeter array. We'll have roughly 20 times more objects than we had previously. And sensitivity per object is much, much higher with ALMA than we had previously with the quasars. Yeah. So we expect to get orders of magnitude improvements in the substructure per halo.
That's Are we sure variables don't affect the substructure?
Well, okay, yeah. So So we're looking at objects which are not luminous. Okay. So the reason that they're not luminous is that they never form stars. Then probably we're okay. If instead all of these thousands of subhalos form stars, the stars mess up the profile and then left. Then we're in trouble.
For instance, I think Dragon has a number of lensing, deep lensing, so not strong deep lensing. People are concerned that variance could actually affect the lensing power or at sufficiently high L.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is not, of course, not the same scales, not the same type of
phenomenon. Yeah, that's right. But our probe isn't measuring the power spectrum.
As the state.
Yeah, that's right. It's counting objects in this sense. And so very long because we don't expect to affect how many of these dark matter halos form.
Yeah. So to the extent galaxy formation is suppressed in these small halos anyway, we wouldn't expect very long effects to be important for the galaxy.
Right. And empirically we know that galaxy formation is suppressed in objects because of the missing satellites problem.
That's right.
But
different from
weak
cleansing
there was a maximum K that we could believe in through the variance physics. So what is that?
And well, that depends upon the level of error you were willing to tolerate. So like percent errors, I thought it was like K.1 or something.
People usually don't go beyond multiple of 3,000 in their analyses for these concerns, and that converts to what K, I'm not sure. But it's 1/10 of a radian. Yeah, I can't do it. I don't know exactly what K.
Yeah, so I thought that for K is around like 0.1 or so, that's become larger than the percent level. But I might be misremembering.
Okay. 0.1.
I remember K1 is a sweet spot of weak lensing, that is to say cosmic variances and shot noise dominate on larger and smaller scales respectively. That's K1. So
K1 they're not heads or enormous.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to address a little bit this question about basically these phenomenological models, you know. Let me give you an example. I mean, the state of the art of these basically galaxy bias parameters. The assumption is the local galaxy density is determined by the local dark matter density, that they are related by some bias parameter. Now, it's not unreasonable to expect that local galaxy density is in fact determined by more things than that. For example, even just sticking with local things, for example, the local tidal field, for example. And those things haven't been explored a whole lot, actually. So if it turns out at some small level you have to include those things, that has to be looked at. To what extent they affect ultimately your FNF constraint? Those things have not been looked at.
But for local effects, it's clear how you parameterize it. You'd write down everything that's local and you write in some Taylor series and you'd assign a coefficient for each one and you'd ask how many of these do I need to know in order to get at a certain scale to get the level of precision I need to do. So, and the tidal field is just one such term and such an expansion. It's two derivatives acting on phi, so it's the Newtonian potential. So it's, you know, it's clearly a term you would write down in some type of Taylor series. It's not some non-local effect, although some people like to call it non-local bias, but it's clearly a locally measured. Tidal forces are a locally measurable thing. So in that sense, I agree that systematically going through it is what you want to do, but that, I mean, again, it's just to the degree that we don't even know what the counting looks like. Like what you'd want to know whether it's a problem or not is to say, as I go up and for a number of K, how many new parameters do I, if I go up by from K to 0.1 to 0.2, how many new parameters do I need? How much data does it take to measure those parameters accurately enough, and how much is left over for me to measure my bias spectrum? Or can I do separate measurements? So I can measure it in one system that leaves the bispectral measurement alone, because I can measure multiple bispectra, so I could imagine having lots of data. So, I mean, I don't know if to the extent, my observations suggest that it hasn't been done at that level of, like the tidal term has been studied a little bit and people found evidence that it matters, but I mean, it's...
Is this evidence comparing the perturbative calculations to simulations or to actual...
Comparing perturbative calculations to simulations.
The simulations don't have any serious memory effects or...
they're just dark matter simulations. So they're looking at this term, like some tidal type effect in just the formation of dark matter halos, compared to the linear theory for the just average dark matter distribution. But it's at that level, the evidence is they computed a bispectrum from simulations and they said the only way to get this term, to match the simulated data is to add this one extra term. Given that they know that the initial conditions for their simulation were some Gaussian distribution. But I mean, in principle, that's what one, at the level of just dark matter, one could imagine doing that purely with simulations. And to the degree that, you know, to some degree, you should expect these coefficients could be done with just Gaussian simulations. Because the non-Gaussian part is just encoded in the correlation functions of these higher terms. So.
For the halos, sure.
For the halos. For galaxies, I agree. But just for starting with halos, I mean, like just to see to what degree that, if you just want to say how well does this procedure work, that's a perfectly reasonable starting point. I mean, if it works for halos, okay, there's galaxies are, but you do the same thing for galaxies. You just assign new parameters. Is that not fair? I mean, that would be your natural guess.
We have no idea, though, now how to calibrate those parameters, right?
You'd have to do it using real data, which is...
Right, yeah, so then how do you then... I mean, right, but, you know, so for halos, you can imagine calibrating these numbers as simulations. For galaxies, we don't know how to simulate galaxies, and so we...
Okay, you have to calibrate the data.
Can you give an example of a parameter that you would be talking about just to make it concrete if possible? So, I'm still trying to understand where
permission
theory fits in, where you just...
Well, me and Lowell know a lot more about this, but since I'm more simple-minded, I'll just do really, really simple. So I think the assignment of galaxies often looks like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here. So this is the mass of a halo. This is like a famous plot they're showing in HRD, and this is the number of galaxies. And that there's a relation between them that's... Well, it's 1-to-1 and some scatter is given. And usually it says starting at some mass, you know, there's one, so this is one, maybe this is 10, this is 100. Starting at some mass, halo is less massive, this has no galaxies. This mass has one galaxy, and above that, it's a power law. Mm-hmm. And that power law looks like n is equal to n, you know, n to the alpha. Alpha is one such parameter.
Okay, but so you're doing some perturbation theory calculation where you're correcting everything that comes into this, like the dark matter density and the Newtonian potential.
Right, yeah.
That was something that you could just do and there'd be...
Yeah, exactly, you're right, yeah. And so in principle, if you write down, you know, your delta halo or delta galaxy is equal to some, you know, matter bias times delta matter, and then plus other terms that, you know, that are, say, like, you know, V2 delta matter squared, or for example, you know, things like things like the tidal field, you know, TIJ, TLJ, tidal plus.
This totally systematically. Those are just all the things that are in the problem. It's not like you have to decide, oh, I'm going to add some new parameter.
If all that matters is matter density, grad I, grad J, tri.
If all you have is dark matter, which you consider to be non-interacting, and right. Gravity, then it's all determined what.
That's right. Yeah, so pure dark matter.
So now there's this alpha. So
alpha is just pulled out of air.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. So this corresponds to one very, very simple way of assigning galaxies to halos. Okay.
So I'm confused about this. Can you relate the two sides of the board? So.
Sure. Okay. Well. Right. Okay. Yeah. So here what we're saying is that the mean number
the mean number of galaxies per, you know, per halo is some function of the mass, right? Okay, and so therefore the number density of galaxies on average, you know, is therefore some, you know, some other function time, you know, some other function therefore of the mass density, right? And if we tailor expand this function, you know, then we get these, you know, these terms, right? Okay. Now, besides this very simple way of assigning galaxies, we, you know, we can also imagine this would be some function of the halo mass. Let's say the local environment of the halo. You know, who knows what, right? Okay. And if I tailor expand this bigger function, now I'll have other terms appearing here, right?
Do we know what big F and little f are?
No. Oh, no, I mean, from first principles, you mean, or? No, we don't know, right?
Okay. Because it's only like, you know, so we know, suppose we know the statistics of the initial conditions that we're trying to go forward, but we're trying to stay in a linearized regime.
What we do know how to compute is the number of dark matter halos that form and how they cluster, right? Again, that can be computed pretty reliably from simulations. And then if we also then know how to assign galaxies to those halos, we can then also then reliably compute the number of galaxies that form, how they cluster, right?
But the second part is phenomenological, right? It's not first principles way.
We have no first principles way to assign galaxies to halos.
Okay, so the perturbation theory that I just talked about is sort of on top of this phenomenological.
So most of the perturbative calculations, I guess, that I've seen have been trying to, you know, have been trying to understand how the dark matter evolves in clusters. So
to be more concrete, this delta matter in that expression, that's perturbation, that's described by some pressureless fluid to first approximation, and it solves an equation that you can, that's nonlinear, that you could solve order by order in some expansion around the sort of linearized regime. So to the extent that delta was, the fluctuations of delta were small, you would imagine the nonlinear terms were small, and you could imagine doing perturbation theory.
Exactly. So my confusion was, to stop you, and this is the last time I'll slow things down with my stupid questions, but we have, you know, these tiny fluctuations that seeded everything. Or whatever, we just assume we know the initial conditions. As Sarah said, we don't really know reheating, but suppose we just give you the initial conditions and we specify that we're in the linearized regime. That alone would say that everything would be calculable perturbatively, but that's not what's being said here.
Yeah, so the delta, so we would say at that level, to the degree that perturbation theory holds, you'd say the delta m's that appear in this expression are solvable. We know how to take initial conditions, determine delta m's.
Good.
Now what this parameterization says is if you want to then go to observations, there's one more step which involves some parameters that you don't know and you need to include. You need to include that, say, I want to compute a correlation function of delta g, not delta m. I then need to include a bunch of different correlation functions in terms of delta m, each one of which I could, in principle, compute perturbatively. But in the coefficient.
The jump is getting the galaxies out of the original linearized perturbation theory.
Yes, that's right.
And as such, when you guys say, oh, we're still in a linearized regime, I mean, for the reason of that last step, you're not. I mean, you're saying you can't. Okay, yeah, okay, so I understand.
So the galaxies are, so again, that's where if you look on large scales, you think the galaxies are just like tracers of the sort of the number of galaxies. So you're not, again, not asking, is there one galaxy here versus there? You're asking, are there on average more in a big box of some big size?
I don't care about the few cells.
Yeah. But that you think traces, in this sense of this parameterization, traces something that is perturbative, and to the extent that these things are just tracers, then
tracers with some quote unquote bias.
And
that's one of the
phenomenological
parameters.
That's right.
And then given that. Okay.
But for large scales, right?
Yeah, for large scales. When things, everything's nonlinear, you have no hope of doing anything with perturbation theory. But to the degree that the dark matter is perturbative, you might imagine such a procedure would converge, that there's some finite number of these that you would need to know in order to make predictions. Right? Is there a reason to think that if I told you delta M is in a regime where I can solve its behavior arbitrarily accurately with perturbation theory, that for some reason this part of it would totally break down and I have no hope of parameterizing it? Is it?
If Galaxy formation depends on, you know, yeah.
Let's start with the halos.
Galaxy depends upon things besides just the properties of the halos. Yeah. Then
But if we were just talking about halos and not galaxies, would you say there's some obstacle to level of halos, or you're just saying it's strictly the halo to galaxy that's the technical difficulty?
Well, that's my main concern. Yeah.
Your main concern is that, but is that a well agreed upon situation? Delta halo is
halo to galaxy is the super hard part.
So, okay, so so delta halo being parameterized by bias is not considered at all an obstacle. It's just that whether the galaxy
compared to the other one.
As long as you are sufficiently general.
Wait, sorry, can you say that again?
In your bias coefficients.
Halo to galaxy is different
from
bias.
So there's a bias for halos, which is the big clumps of dark matter, and then there's within a clump of dark matter where how many actual galaxies there are. And
halo bias versus galaxy bias?
Basically, that's right,
And which one is the stumbling block?
Yeah, the galaxies, yeah.
Okay, so there you guys also talk about some parameterization that you're not confident of in this assessment.
Yeah, because in principle, we can imagine galaxy formation will depend upon things besides just gravity.
Okay, good. Okay, so this is where the baryons. Okay.
Yeah, baryons. That's right.
Even back at this step, do you know the matter color spectrum at k greater than 0.1? You were saying that the baryon effects are an issue there.
Oh, you mean like the nonlinear? Sorry.
Right. So I mean, I thought the reason why people only trust the weak grounding matter power spectrum to k of 0.1 is because baryon effects could alter the matter power spectrum at higher k.
Sure.
So my question of confusion is, what k have we measured the matter power spectrum to today? Right. I mean, does L of
from simulations or from real observations?
Yeah. So like L of 3000.
No. That's all forecasts.
I don't know.
You mean weak grounding?
Cosmic shear is extreme.
Capacity. What have we measured the matter power spectrum to? What k?
Matter or galaxy?
Matter?
Oh, matter, not very well. Weak lensing is what up to. There's a very noisy measurements. Very noisy.
And if we take CME extrapolations to the matter power spectrum, what do we trust for regime?
Okay. Right, so we have like gone to like L of like 1000 or something, is that about right?
Weak lensing?
No, CMB, she's saying. CMB extrapolations
and regime.
The capping tail is making it hard for us to go to very high k, right? So
you're trying to back out the primordial P of k from the CMB. But, okay, are you.
So my
we know it works, right?
So my question is, how much more room is there to gain between what we've already measured and k of 0.1, which is seems to be a limit of what we trust in terms of predicting the matter power spectrum, because we don't even know what the baryons are doing to matter power spectrum, right?
So there's two separate, I guess, power spectra we're talking about here, right? Yes, we have the primordial power spectrum, which will be, and that primordial P of K is the actual power spectrum of, that's important. And with lensing, we can also measure the nonlinear power spectrum today. And so it's the nonlinear power spectrum, I think, which is limited by, by sort of baryonic effects. At the percent level, yeah, something like that. Right. But in principle, we can constrain the primordial power spectrum beyond that, right? And so the forest, for example, is already pushing down to k of like 1 or so.
So why can't, I mean, baryons, if dark matter can be treated perturbatively, why can't baryons be treated perturbatively? If at 0.1 I trust dark matter, like why can't I just add a second fluid called baryons and couple the two? I mean, there's to the degree that they're both described by fluids.
Okay.
Because is the argument that it's not linear at 0.1, or is the argument that baryons are important at 0.1? Because if baryons are important, why don't I just add that to my perturbation theory?
It's baryons on parameters. Baryons are capable of having phenomena at extremely high K affecting the low K stuff. Let's say a supernova explosion, very local, very high K stuff. But that can actually drive mass flow up to very large scales. So is whereas that doesn't happen in gravity. In gravity, the worst thing that happened, oh, you found a black hole, doesn't. So that's the difference between baryons.
But I can't integrate that out. I can't think of the baryons as being an effective fluid on large scales with some, where the small scale effects just affects the behavior of the large scale.
You're sensitive to UV physics, if you like. that's what's going on.
I mean, the memory effects sound pretty interesting to try and capture.
Is it memory effects or? Because memory effects, okay.
That's also a memory effect. That's the effect that Neil alluded to. For example, when the universe first reionized, there are these big, bubbles of basically ionized hydrogen, right? And these bubbles can be actually go to very large scale. They can be 100 megaparsec. And it could be these very large scale bubbles, they get imprinted in the later galaxy formation. And so the clustering of galaxies that you see, even up to 100 megaparsec scale, is somehow affected by something as simple as just, you know, ionization of a hydrogen atom by radiation. And it's, you know, that's the kind of problem you face when you look at baryons. That small scale stuff can actually affect very large scale stuff.
When it comes to things like explosions, I mean, can't you, even though you can't get those to come out fully from some simulations in themselves, can't you just say it exploded and then track it further?
In simulations, you mean?
Say in the simulations, or if you're trying to estimate how big these kinds of
that what simulation cannot predict for you is, you know, how often do these explosions occur?
That's the kind
of thing they cannot rely on.
Okay, but the fact that it can have this effect over large scales, given that it explodes, is that something you have control over, say? Then you can at least parameterize your ignorance.
Let's say if you can tell me how often do these things occur, and you know roughly what is the energy involved in each explosion, then yeah, you can estimate.
Is there any consensus on the first generation of stars then?
Consensus in terms of what?
How massive they were, how ubiquitous they were when they formed.
I don't think we have anything by way of direct evidence, but there's certainly some ideas. Generally fairly massive star.
That's what I thought. And I mean, what, you know, one thing obviously is very important for the mass loss is the effect on subsequent baryon physics because of the composition would change. Hydrogen, helium, very inefficient coolant. But once you have heavier elements, the cooling becomes far more efficient, especially if you can form things like OH and stuff.
Yeah, molecule structure.
Yeah. So there isn't really any.
There isn't any consensus here.
I mean, are they, you know, do you form 1,000 solar mass stars at a redshift of 100, say?
A redshift of 100, yeah, probably not many stars are forming. But the first stars, you know, could be quite massive. But that is still, I think, pretty controversial. So Sprinkle's new fancy moving mesh code gets smaller stars. Well, I'm not sure.
But then also the issue that Lamb is bringing up about stronger in spheres that send out a lot of ionizing radiation, you know, that could start moderately early, right?
That's the most extreme example, right? So you start off with a universe that's mostly neutral. So let's say it starts from here, and they give out a lot of energetic photons. The photons ionize a big region around that. So around that big region, the gas is systematically hotter. So you can easily imagine that affect the rate of galaxy formation within that region compared to the other side. And so this is just one galaxy, very local. In fact, thing could be very large regions. And those are the kind of things you have to deal with.
And presumably very massive stars evolve very quickly and could explode as well, right? I mean, they might leave a black hole behind, but they could also eject quite a bit of mass.
That's right. That's, yeah. So supernova explosions, so that's direct mass transfer. So, but the ionization effect, that could be even larger.
Right. Yeah. That could be bigger. Yeah.
I feel like I should know more about this because Tom Abell does these things, but I don't know. You guys, he's so into that. I don't know.
Yeah, in fact, I thought he sort of had the state of the art for the first stars. And Mike Norman, guys like that.
Yeah, that was my understanding, but I still don't know the answer here.
Yeah. I should say, though, I mean, this idea that these big bubbles might leave an imprint. I don't think we have any direct evidence of that either. But it's just something that could occur. But it's something that you have to keep an eye out for when the precision of your data get better and better. You have to watch out for these effects.
So I think you're answering my early question in the affirmative, meaning if we could understand all these things, we would understand some really interesting normal physics as well. The primordial test.
In fact, that's why I was going to say, these effects are interesting from astrophysical perspectives. It's good to actually know about them if they are there.
So actually, I asked at the Planck meeting about ionization and whether ionization is patchy when the universe reionizes. And the answer I got surprised me, and it's actually rather different. I mean, the answer I got was that it was small enough scale that they wouldn't resolve the effect.
From microwave background, you're saying?
I'm just quoting. and actually, I had always thought, as you did, that you could get very large, H2 regions, or whatever you want to call them, forming from the early.
I don't think we know anything about the size of these bubbles.
So Planck doesn't have polarization yet, so I'm not sure how they would constrain the size of the patches.
Yeah, I mean, that obviously would be the best thing to know about it. Yeah.
So getting to these questions, is Planck one wall, basically, where we really can't theoretically model the matter power spectrum beyond? And then my question is, where are we now?
So there was a paper in the Heitman et al. Paper, they did a comparison of simulations of how well they predict the dark matter power spectrum. This is maybe 2008 or 2009, so it's a few years old. And this is like they plot the relative difference of P of K on the y-axis as a function of K on the x-axis relative to one of these simulations. And they all check together at 5% spread, and then a K of 0.1 they diverge. So now I think that's been pushed to maybe a slightly higher K than 0.1.
What's the comparison?
Of simulations.
Simulations.
Dark matter only simulations to each other.
Oh, simulations to each other.
To each other, yeah. Different simulations, different, not the same, different people, different codes.
Okay. You say they're simulating each other?
They're all simulating the standard benchmark lambda CDM model. They press enter, they run simulation, they get P of K at K of 0, at Z of 0, I suppose. And so this gives you an idea that they agree to 5%-ish out to K of 0.1, maybe slightly higher, then they tend to diverge to 20%.
Is the divergence due to adding some sort of baryon mechanism, or what is that?
So I believe these are dark matter only.
They should give the same.
So they're nonlinear.
They must have mass, basically a particle mass.
Right.
Is that coming into play in those cases already?
Right. This is all the nonlinear.
I mean, that's really all it could be.
It may have been K. Sorry, I misspoke. It was K of 1.
I misspoke.
It was out to K of 1, they agree. And so this is well into the nonlinear regime.
And this is the Captain
one of the Heitman et al. Papers, 2007 or 2009. They have a comparison of simulations.
If you add baryons, they will diverge at 0.1.
At some other, yeah. Sorry, K of 1 they diverge. They agree to 5-10% out of K of 1.
So for the nonlinear, yeah, present day power spectrum, that's different than the primordial power spectrum that we're trying to actually get to, right? So we can do better than this 0.1, if that's your question.
Well, so my question was, you're trying to get to that by measuring the dark matter power spectrum, or?
Was like measuring various things, right? Yeah. The dark matter power spectrum could be measured, you know, for example, from lensing, right? Yeah. We also have other probes of structure. So, for example, Lyman Alpha Forest has gotten certainly past 0.1 already.
How did they, for the dark matter power spectrum?
For the primordial power spectrum, yeah.
But don't they need to, okay, so what dark matter power spectrum K did they go to get that?
Okay. Well, so presumably it went down to K of like 1 or even beyond. And,
but so my question is, you're saying we can't predict that because we don't know the baryon effects on the matter power spectrum below K of 0.1. So then how did they do that?
Yeah, so they were, well, right, so they were, right, so they would start with, right, so different primordial power spectra, and then compute the evolution of the Lyman alpha forest. The forest is not terribly sensitive to very high density regions like galaxies, and so you're, I guess, sort of less sensitive to all the messy baryon physics. That's my vague. Would you agree, Ram?
Right, but I can imagine that's different for Lyman alpha than like a galaxy survey.
Sure.
How about this question of do we want to influence future surveys? Do you have any thoughts on this? What were your thoughts?
No, we don't.
You mean like optimized survey design?
I mean, to some extent, in the optimization, probably we would want to influence things, but that's a pretty, it's a good, you know, so I don't know if there's anything bigger scale than that. You know, just how you choose window function. And
like, yeah, which aspect of a survey would you want to design or change and how? Maybe even like just like a very high level question. Maybe bigger volume is obvious, but bigger.
Yeah. So is higher Z more important or is lower K more important?
Yeah, sometimes you have actually trade-offs that you have freedom to specify at the design level.
The only comparison I saw of this was in an Elisa Pilipich paper talking about Eurozeta, and they tried to say if we'd change the survey XYZ way, would we have done better, like for FNL? And so it was pretty much no.
FNL local?
Again, FNL local.
Okay. Right, right. I mean, changing K would seem to have the...
Oh, sure. I mean,
more modes, et cetera.
Sure, sure. Sorry, so I'm saying other things like do you make other trade-offs in how you... I mean, you can just plot K max and K min, but other details, et cetera.
Yeah, in terms of, let's consider the low K part, the last gear stuff. For that, is radial modes, which means in the Z direction, better or angular modes, in terms of systematics, being able to measure them better? Do you guys have a sense?
Well, for radial modes, I guess, then you have to deal with redshift evolution.
You have to deal with evolution, selection function.
Right.
Angular modes, you have to deal with
calibration.
Calibration, star galaxy separation. Do you have a sense which ones are better?
I thought calibration is a bad problem, but these others are too, so I don't know.
What is the calibration problem?
It's hard to do absolute calibration here versus here. Yeah.
To have uniform depth on the sky as a functional location, basically, to which you trust your going. So by going a little bit deeper here, you're seeing a little bit more galaxies here, and you're misinterpreting that as power.
Right. So BOSS, for example, initially had some great FNL detection, which was always completely spurious because of calibration issues on
Mars. They still do have some big bump that they hide by plotting out to scale.
That's true.
Yeah.
But depending on the answer to the question, that might affect whether you want a deeper survey versus a wider survey, which would trade off, as you said.
So, Bu Jin, I've heard him say a very smart thing at one of the collaboration meetings of some experiment, which is if you just look at statistical errors, you always go for wider. Mm-hmm. You give smaller cosmic variances beaten down, you've got volumes, everything works in your favor. But once you start looking at systematics, then you suddenly start getting driven toward deeper. Mm-hmm. That's a good thought, because it's probably true.
And I thought actually the pill-pitch comparison for deeper was that, at least for what they did, it wasn't better. I mean, there's a little table we can pull it up, but it wasn't, you know, it's not.
If going wider wasn't as good as going deeper?
Going deeper wasn't any better than going wider, even. But I don't know how carefully they did systematize.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many parameters, degrees of freedom here. It's even hard to wrap one's mind around what you would need to vary, you know, in like a real world. Redshifts and redshift follow-up to calibrate redshifts. It's...
Are there multiple projects that will do each approach? Or...
Yeah, I think one big division rather than Y versus, that's maybe an artificial one, is photometric versus spectroscopic. We talked about this earlier today. Mm-hmm. You know, so for most surveys are photometric, they just get images of objects. They don't have their 3D information, so they are what some people call 2.5D, which is they get what's called photometric redshift, which is quick and dirty way to get redshifts out of them. And then you get something like 100 million objects from Sloan, for example. And then spectroscopic, Sloan also has spectroscopic part, which is probably two orders of magnitude fewer objects, but you get exact 3D information by measuring spectra. And so that's kind of a big, not divide, but big separation. Which one is it, spectroscopic or photometric? And which ones will do better? That's, I guess, not known at this time for probing, you know, low K, large scales, for example.
For smaller K, do you win by having better redshift just because you gain that extra direction, or is the trade-off with number of galaxies too severe?
So for BAO, for example, I believe that you do much, much better with, well, you know, on 3D compared to 2D, like, you know, so DES, for example, will be doing BAO, but its forecasts are pretty pitiful compared to, you know, a full 3D spectroscopic.
So typical photo Z error, and they have much more just in the sigma, there's way more, but typical photo Z error is 8.05 delta Z. That, I think, converts to 150 megaparsecs, if I'm doing that correctly in my head. So every object is shifted by, you know, it's not a Gaussian, but by 150 megaparsecs. So yeah, I guess small scales are murdered by that.
I see.
While very large scales may not be. Well, you can try to undo that, but that's a very hard problem. People are working on that, like mapping the photo Z's accurately. Because if you know what kinds of errors you're making, you can undo them exactly. Problem is, you have error in your mapping of the photo Z's. That is to say, in your knowledge of how much error with what distribution are you making at any given Z. So people used to speak about just photo Z error being, the error is 0.03, you know. But then it's way more, it's a whole distribution, you know, for every galaxy at Z of 0.5 has a funny distribution. It might be multimodal. It's a mess. And then a galaxy at Z of 0.7 has a different distribution. So. Yeah, so that's what the PhotoZ surveys face, but they have maybe two orders of magnitude more galaxies or objects, so that's where they win. Not sure how to influence their design to make it primordial physics specific.
Well, the answer to 2 no, or they seem to jump to 3 and 4, but. And there are projects going on that are going to. Used this way.
So BAO surveys will be useful, you know, for non-Gaussianity, I mean, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
But I guess if you that work has then exists, they're not first generating the object. Mostly you're in the numbers of the local, but they're just not that much better, especially once you make them honest.
They're not much better than the very good Planck constraint.
That's right.
Okay, but again, the Planck constraint is not so. Some grain on the other shapes, so maybe there's more room.
Yeah, the other shapes have, I don't know, good numbers for those.
I don't know, if you say 5 times better than Planck, I don't know why you are
pessimistic even on that account.
But they're not really, right? I mean, so the very, very best one for Euclid, like we know is optimistic in many ways, was 5 times better. But all the others were 3, and those are optimistic, instead of 6, so.
3 might pan out to factor of 3 better, and that would be
something.
But even for the other shapes, the uncertainty is all and where do I stop, right, in small k. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you take the most conservative estimates, it doesn't look that much better. Like maybe I think Ichiro at the conference said that they could get down to FNL. So okay, as a starting point, with moderately conservative, they said you could FNL equilateral 20, which is already almost a factor of 4 better than Planck. But that's also with a very conservative estimate on K, and the uncertainty of how high you can go in K is this entire discussion we've had as to whether you can realistically do better than the most conservative estimates.
I mean, factor of 4 is pretty good.
Factor of 4 is already pretty good, but again, that was Planck forecast would have told you 20 to 30 or 40, depending on how you looked at their papers. So it's totally reasonable giving Planck forecasts, but if you thought that they do worse by the same amount Planck did, then it's less of an improvement. But again, I think the uncertainty on what they'll actually do is strict, but there's a cube in there, and you have, I mean, you can win, you can change numbers by order 2 to 10, depending on what you put in. So I don't know if one should be pessimistic or optimistic, because it's so sensitive to our ability to sort this stuff out. But
is there a target? Actually, maybe that was one of your points. The target goal, this is for dark energy, you always get this question and nobody knows the answer. But maybe for non-Gauss, for R, you told us the answer in your couple of occasions. But how about for non-Gaussianity? Is there a target value of FNL equilateral or local?
I would say target, I mean, an amazing target, which people will just probably laugh at, is getting to order 1 would be amazing.
In local?
In equilateral.
In equilateral.
In equilateral. There's, I mean, there.
Can you remind us what you gain? Why is this?
Well, I would say so. There's a natural. So this was Eva mentioned this in her in the Blackboard talk. But the rough idea is that there's a scale in associated with inflation. There's sort of 2 scales we know about. There's, if you took slow roll, there's H and there's phi naught, and the ratio of H. So phi dot is bigger than h squared by a factor of 57 squared. So phi dot to the 1/4 is 57 times h. So there's a scale. There's another scale in the problem, which is h. And you what FNL equilateral is probing in a lot of examples is just sort of the strength of some self interactions, like how much things are coupled to each other. And that's controlled by some scale as well. There's a third scale, mm-hmm. and we're putting bounds on that third scale. And given, it would be nice to be able to constrain that scale to be comparable to the other scale in the problem we know, which is sort of parametrically this phi dot like mm-hmm. scale. And the current bounds are off of that by quite a bit. Like they're order 5 as opposed to order 50. So I mean, it's a significant way to go, but. But that's, I mean, it's a natural scale in the problem, so you might like to have gone through that scale. You've at least checked if there's something that's happening at that scale, because we know that scale exists, and it would be interesting to probe there.
That's a really, really nice bottom-up way of explaining a sort of threshold that you can go through. Mm-hmm. And then if you ask about particular models, for non-Gaussianity, I think it's really not understood systematically from the top down. They're just interesting examples that do whatever they do, and in those you could ask the same question. So far it hasn't seemed to me like there's, from that point of view, that there's a obvious threshold from the models that I know. They don't happen to have this feature of all being determined by one, you know, f pi like scale. That doesn't mean it's still a good fiducial scale to look at, but. But you know, things keep getting learned. So at the conference, if you have energy to pay attention, there was a semi-new idea called unwinding inflation. It sort of combines a bunch of different previous ideas. One of which involves sort of relativistic motion, where there's dBi effects, and they found that it's the thing that I found interesting about that. So I'm just mentioning this as a sort of place where the threshold has actually been found. For reasons we can explain microscopically, they actually find a prediction for how relativistic it should be, and it's not, it's, before we had no particular reason to say it should be ultra-relativistic or not, and that determined how non-Gaussian or more like slow roll it would be. But in their scenario, which has some nice features, it's kind of boxed in. They say like the gap, the basically the inverse sound speed is supposed to be something order 20 or whatever. So that this is just an example of a mechanism in which, you know, by further work, people, you know, have in a model dependent but interesting way, you know, something.
Do they have a range for non-Gaussianity in that?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They sort of do, and it's again, it uses some previous ideas, but it in the, I shouldn't give a lecture on all of the motivation for this particular scenario, but let me just try and say again, it has some motivations, and it boxes in the non-Gaussianity into the range that's not yet probed, but
that's some range.
Yeah, as opposed to when we previously found these mechanisms that help lead to all this attempt to understand how to study it systematically. We couldn't really say how big the Langevin areas could be, and sometimes they wanted to be bigger. They want to be big just because they're helping slow down the inflaton and keep it, you know, keep, which is how you produce inflation. So in the past, I was, you know, already just sort of got constrained, and there didn't seem to be much of a threshold. But, you know, new ideas do come up every so often, and mm-hmm. In this particular sort of, it's not really a hugely new idea, but it's a interesting mm-hmm. package in which there's mm-hmm. a reason that it's kind of boxed in. I mean, with the B modes, the thing I always emphasize about them is we're not, you know, the current constraints are, they're not yet into the really interesting regime, but they're about to get there. And for non-Gaussianity, we haven't really had that statement to make, right, in the past. And in a model-dependent way, it's interesting when people come up with cases where you do, and then this effective field theory point is a very nice way of just, if you know nothing, you can at least aim for that single scale model. So
they always ask you this, certainly when you're writing any proposals, but even outside, they always want people, well, naturally they want to have targets and motivations. Yeah. And we do too, you know, it's hard to get motivated to do this, well, this huge mess at small scales, right? But if there's a really nice prize somewhere, even if there's a chance for it, it's,
well, I think what one has to do, and this again you can make analogies to the B modes or even to the L modes, you have to be prepared for the null result and be interested in that. I'm not saying that's what it should be. I have hopes for these things that are, you know, have some motivation behind it. But I think, you know, you could say a null result on something really interesting is worthwhile, right? So you have to be prepared for that, obviously.
Right.
I think with supersymmetry at the LHC, it's an obviously good thing to do, whichever way it goes. And I think that's true of BMOs, and I think it's true of Langevinity. It's just a good thing to. But it's definitely a fair question.
Right.
Well, there's a standard thing which basically the reasonable simplistic assumptions, there's a direct relationship between the range of the inflaton, and this is an inflation, the range of the inflaton excursion, and the B modes, and happily the bulk range of field coincides with the amplitude of the tensor to scalar ratio that they expect to be able to experimentally probe. So it's a threshold, it's a real threshold, it's kind of like a TV scale in particle physics. 0.01-ish range. Mm-hmm. But, you know, most of the large inflation scenarios that predict it are a bit bigger than that, so if that's the right answer, we have a good chance of seeing it before getting literally down to 0.01, but there's a threshold there. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if non-Gaussianity one would call this f pi such a threshold.
I would say it's a threshold in the following sense, that if, at least from the effective theory point of view, if the scale that appears there is below f pi significantly, then you would say I need to introduce something new happening which has nothing to do, which is before you'd expect to be writing down. You wouldn't expect it's necessarily just slow roll with a small correction that gave which gave that effect. So above that you could write down slow roll plus small effects, like plus operators that are under control of effective theory for the background.
Okay, I agree.
So that's all I meant, that you could good. The difference between being able to write it as a slow roll plus small correction versus not, I think, a really important
point. For some reason I got discouraged from trying to compare it to slow roll, which formally is just on your plot.
It's
really hard. Yeah, but if it's when you cross this threshold, you're closer to slow roll than you in some well-defined sense.
Yeah, so I would say, like, maybe I'll just write it on the board so it's clear. So if you had a slow roll model, you could write down. So this would be my Lagrangian, and then I could add to it something. Let's just take this thing where there's just some scale here. And if this scale lambda is above phi naught, then it makes sense to talk about this theory when describing inflation. This is a small correction to this, so you write down, you could imagine doing slow roll and then just adding a small correction.
So this is more than the theory of the pies. This is the
this is like slow roll plus small correction.
Yeah, okay.
And this type of effect can be a Bethernelli collateral. But it's sort of less than one. Because the constraint that I don't want this scale to be bigger than, because if this scale, if lambda was less than phi dot, then it would mean that these higher kinetic terms are important. But now I have four derivative equations of motion, and it's not really a reasonable single field description to include this term and not think of it in these dynamics. So to the extent that once you have to treat this as part of the dynamics of the background versus not, sort of changes the character of what you call the model. I think that's an interesting.
That certainly is what you want to do.
Yeah. So in that sense, I would say this is closer to. But of course, there are models that look nothing like this that also could have equilateral being small. But at least as a, if you detected finality equilateral, so once you're across this threshold, it's. The data at least really likes this type of
practice. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, one of the important things in the actual mechanisms that do this is that lambda is not a hard scale. It depends on phi.
Yeah, no, I totally agree that in something like DBI, you have these types of terms, but there you really are seeing that these terms are important in the description of the background itself.
Right.
It's not, you wouldn't think of it as slow roll plus small correction, you would think of it as fast roll plus interaction.
Right, but what you're saying is this f pi scale distinguishes those two classes.
Yeah, so yeah, the phi dot, yeah, f pi sort of formally takes this argument and just says there's a sort of more model independent sense in which this type of logic, you could have stumbled into this type of logic just from the bottom up.
This MNL1 is not a lower bound though in that sense. The true lower bound would be the modest signal one where
it doesn't say that you have to see it before you hit point one, but it's similar. I would say it's analogous to this R of 0.01, which says if you don't see anything, but you've ruled out this FNL equilateral greater than that, you have gone through sort of an interesting sort of split between classes of models.
They're
models that live on each side, but so you don't have a guaranteed detection, but even just learning that you don't live on one side is a very interesting conclusion. So
I just want to kind of clarify regarding Dragon's question, if you really want, what is the absolute minimum? We know there is an absolute minimum because gravity does have interactions. And so that has to produce an R as in. But that's basically less smaller than this one.
Yeah, I totally agree, although, as you say, we know that. I mean, if it were me doing all this hard work just to find out that, yeah, there are these terms in the, you know,
right.
in interaction of matter with gravity, I'd be more interested in the exploding stars and memory effects part. ideal physics than be getting to the, you know, known interaction term.
And that absolute minimum will be like, well, what percent?
Is that the local only or collateral as well?
Yeah.
Is that the number that people argue? Is it 3 or 5? Is that? No, that's different.
3 or 5
with
extra corrections to the
CMP from
null primary
still. Oh, keep confusing those two. Okay.
Ah, right. But even say that it's 1. The question is, if you believe 20 and that's an optimistic, somewhat optimistic number, and for what surgery is that 20 number?
That was the.
Is that Euclid?
No, that was, what's the insurance?
I have had
this. Oh, okay, well, Hendrix.
Yeah, that was their projection. They're going to higher Z, which got them a little bit more in terms of, again, that was just conservative on the nonlinear scale, but because they went to higher Z, you got to push that down. So that's how they got something like 20. But.
So I don't know what the comparable number would be for Euclid, but I guess we can take like the ratios for local, like goes down by another factor of 4. I have no idea if that's what I'm saying for Euclid.
Well, volume tells you a lot. That head deck site, I just happen to remember from his talk, is like 10 cubic gigabytes. So compare that to a water, 100, even 200, for something like LSST, if you could solve all these issues with non-gradients. So you can imagine there's going to be, one could probably do even just back on envelope. But yeah, the error, it should be a lot better than 20 then, the statistical error.
That the redshift error comes in. Again,
it's also a redshift, right? So you lose a little bit of seeing it.
Again, being equally conservative in both, right. You would lose in the redshift and you'd lose by a lot. But because, again, it's the Q.
Well, some of these Z's go, the surveys go to pretty high, headaches goes to high Z, but some of these go out to almost high Z and are much bigger. So it's.
Well, okay, what's. Yeah, I guess we need to actually know the specifics. But yeah, we
could. Right.
Yeah.
This is impossible to work out without doing exactly. But
I don't know exactly the numbers. Yeah, it's hard to know. But I mean, you see. Yeah, I mean, it's. I mean, but I think.
Yeah, I mean, big bus will be more sparse, but the volume will be way, way, way bigger. This is a few years in the future, and they will have three tracers, but the quasars go all the way out to Z of 4, not very many of them, but you know, they go really deep. So if you're worried about deep, that'll go deep for sure. So I don't know what equilateral, I've done actually a forecast for a local from Big Boss, not for equilateral, but.
I mean, that seems to be a repeated refrain here, that those retrospectives haven't been done, and I think we can say with some confidence that now is at least as interesting, if not before, because of the fact that Planck is so much better on local than it did. I mean, I'm just repeating, but. So, is this on the agenda for people to actually do? To try?
It's on the agenda for sure. We were looking over the W first report that came out last Friday and trying to find there's no non Gaussian numbers at all, so. If anything, people quote local, and then collateral they usually skip, right? It's on the agenda, yeah. I think it should be on the agenda.
But there are very few people that feel like doing the bisection.
Yeah. I think that is a much bigger problem at the moment, which is there's literally no bispectrum analysis from SDSS.
But
as I suggested, that's been 15 years in the making. Is that the claim? For how long?
Oh yeah,
Charles been okay. Talking about this. So, okay. but either way, that's the other side of this. That's important. Is there's the theoretical uncertainty, but if no one knows how to do the analysis, it's more or less irrelevant. Where you stop in K. So it's not. There are many sides to what's going on, but yeah, with equilateral, I mean, the key difference between locals also with a lot of the forecasts you'll see, sometimes they're not doing the bias spectrum,
right.
They're just doing the power spectrum and using the scale-dependent bias. And even with local, you win by, again, depends on numbers, potentially a factor of 5 going to the bias spectrum, even for local, even though there's the scale-dependent effect that allows you to measure the power spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think there's
there's a lot of uncertainty in how well you can do, and you know, some of it is just unknown as to what the real problems are.
But if we put it out to everybody that we know that we want to know which surveys can get FNLA collateral one.
Yeah.
You know, we all see behind that.
Scene.
Well, I think that
can
be an action item.
It could be cranked up for sure.
Yeah.
Just.
Yeah. That could be
a second. Produced as a forecast, like just to set the level of statistic where you know uh-huh. how far down in statistical error can we realistically expect.
Great.
So there's a projection I saw that used, again, and this really pushes into how much do you trust simulations on small scales, but there's a claim using some Halo model that they could get equilateral with Euclid down to like 10. But this is Giantonio. So they were just looking at lensing, so they'd say, so their attitude was, if I measure lensing, I can just do dark matter, so I can trust him. So I just trust simulations. I just simulate to my heart's content, and then I compare the data. And just looking at the power spectrum, again, not like a lensing bias spectrum or anything. They were just saying the equilateral effect. Okay, using some Halo model, using some thresholding model.
Wait, like the effect on the matter power spectrum?
The effect on the matter power spectrum. They were claiming gave them a constraint of 10. Now. It's hard to believe you'd be able to extract that from the data, but the logic for how they got that is clear. They're taking up the K of 10, and so because that's the lowest resolution, they're saying we trust that because we can simulate, and you get some, I mean, so if I did that with a bias spectrum, like a lensing bias spectrum, I would get a ridiculously small error bar in the collateral. Now, of course, I'm not suggesting that this is a realistic procedure, but given how small I could imagine that error bar being if I plugged in K of 10, at what point does this logic fail? Like, where would you follow this logic to?
So K of 10 is, I'm just like, what angular scale do you have? It's like L of like...
L of 20,000.
Oh, okay.
So this is like...
That's crazy.
You know, sub arc minute.
I understand.
Lensing, cosmic shear.
Definitely sub arc minute, yeah.
Yes.
So they're just again. You wouldn't trust. So where would for Euclid should I stop in this kind of estimate?
Of a cosmic shear.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, it's not clear that cosmic shear would ever work out. You know, just have it hugely plagued by problems, and then Euclid will have extra difficulties with, you know. Yeah.
But is there a proposed survey that would have less problems. If I was going to take the attitude, if I just look at, again, if I stick with the attitude that if I'm just observing dark matter, I avoid at least some fraction of the listed problems. So I should try to do that as best I can.
So far it's been lensing, weak lensing specific, not so much survey. I don't think there was any particular well, I don't know how much of the weak lensing observational problems were telescope related, how much were atmosphere related. I'm not sure how that splits into a pie chart, but it's just.
So shape measurements from the ground are like really hard.
Yeah.
But for Euclid or for W first, probably better.
But
K of 10 is also just completely insane because we know that dark matter only is not good enough out there, right? So yeah, you know, so if you have 0.1, I think it's maybe more reasonable for dark matter only. And if it scales like K cubed.
Yeah, you obviously it's I totally understand. that was more of the question. At what point is the statement there is that you wouldn't trust the simulations just because you need baryons at K of 10.
Oh, certainly at K of 10, yeah. You know, a K of 1, yes, and K of 0.1, okay, probably is safe. At the sort of like percent-ish level.
Okay.
Yeah, they usually stop at K of 2,000 to 3,000. I think that's K of 1, and K of 10 is like you said, 10 times more, which is level 20,000.
Those are great people.
Well, I actually think that illustrates how little the community has cared about equilateral. Because if they had said the same thing for local, because their local error bars are just so much worse. Like local is like, yeah, it's super conservative because if they wrote a very optimistic local error bar, I think they would get harassed. But since no one knows what to expect for the collateral, it's like, oh, 12 sounds okay. That's totally reasonable number. So I think that's more symptomatic of the problem, which is since they're the only one in the literature who even has a number, there's no like, is this realistic? Is this unrealistic? And they just, you know, for the point purposes of just showing what you could do, they just threw in these numbers. I mean, they didn't say, like, they definitely added all the caveats, like they're being way too optimistic, but their attitude was, well, we'll just simulate this to death and hope for the best.
Well, another token for the next year. Can take this offline. Yeah, but thanks, Sarah.